Welcome to the Impactful Innovators podcast series. This series is produced from the fall 2020 class at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and sponsored by the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship at RPI. This series highlights the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, and intrapreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond. Today's episode will feature Jeff Stewart, class of 1991. He has started more than half a dozen technology companies that span across four continents and employ over 1,000 people. These companies include Mimio, Lendo, Urgent Group, Urgent Ventures, Urgent Career, and Square Earth, which merged with Proxicom in a successful IPO. Jeff has been called a risk taker and an expert in developing, and then using internet technology to successfully employ business models. Jeff earned a bachelor's degree in business management with a concentration in entrepreneurship at Rensselaer.
Thank you for having me. I'm going to give a little background on, I've started about a dozen companies. I'm going to talk about the inspiration and some of the key takeaways from a bunch of those companies. Then talk a little bit about what I'm working on now, some of the things I'm thinking about, you know, as far as the world needs for startups that don't yet exist, and hopefully do that quickly enough that we can have plenty of time for questions, which is probably the more interesting aspect. I always think that you can't really teach entrepreneurs things. You can only show them things that have worked and not worked and explain and give them context on why they worked or didn't work in my situation, and then for yourself, figure out whether it's applicable for you. So I graduated Rensselaer in 91. I specifically went there because I was interested in starting companies. I started a couple as a kid, and I thought back then that you started a company as you invented something and then you built a company around it. So I figured I'd be an engineer. And then I met the dean of the business school, and he explained that you actually could study business in and around engineering, and that is a good foundation if you want to start companies. So I was excited about that and took every class I could get my hands on related to starting companies at RPI as a management major. When I graduated, became a management consultant, had some great mentors, lived out of a suitcase for about 4 years, saw how big corporations buy things, which is helpful because they do spend an awful lot of money. I saw how big corporations managed and ran things, but also saw how they mismanaged. And then in around 1995, I was doing a project for the NASDAQ as a management consultant. And I got to look at technologies that might affect the capital markets and got to play around with this little thing called the World Wide Web. And I remember looking, and there were almost 800 companies that had websites. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of information. This is interesting. I'm going to take notes of this. So I came back a day later and there were 1,600. I remembered from my math class that when something doubles in a day, it's growing pretty fast, and figured that the internet would be growing fast enough that it would make up for the fact that I really didn't know what I was doing as it related to starting a company. At the same time, a good friend and fraternity brother from Hall at RPI, Dave Utendale, he had been actually deploying systems at Solomon Brothers. We got together and we said, this is going to be huge. And I was at the time living out of a suitcase. I gave him a blank check, said there's $900 in the in that bank account. Why don't you figure out how we start a company? And by the end of the week, we had a company. And then it took us a little longer to figure out what our business model was. We tried a bunch of things and did that sort of classic pivot. We had crazy ideas like a search engine or like a directory or a tool to publish web pages, bookstore. One of our favorites was a catalog of catalogs. At the end of the day, we ended up helping large corporations. That company was called Square Earth. We helped large corporations with complex internet projects. We worked with a lot of agencies in the advertising space to help companies like Bass Ale and Compaq Computer, Pfizer, get online, and grew that business. what was interesting is when we started, we would go to these big corporations. I like to say my competitive advantage was I owned a suit, because a lot of the people who were involved in the internet back then weren't, it seemed like people who were busy doing business, they weren't going to learn the internet. Our big competitive advantages is we pulled a bunch of all-nighters and figured it out, and we could go into a meeting with very senior executives and know more about the internet than anyone in the room, because back then there just wasn't that much to know. It was changing so quickly, you could become a world expert very quickly. For about a year and a half, we would have all these meetings saying how you really should be online, the internet's important, we know what we're talking about, and we grew gradually. And then one day, the phone really started ringing. These companies kind of woke up and said, hey, where were those kids who were telling us about the internet? We need to hire them. So that allowed us to grow even faster. We got a line of financing against our receivables, which really allowed us to grow even faster. Then we merged with a venture-backed company called Proxycom. We bought a third company called Ibis, and then went public, which back then, you could go public much earlier in your life cycle and at a much lower valuation than you would today. So that was a lot of fun, really a fun experience. Very quickly after we merged, I became fascinated with an idea I'd actually had back in right after I graduated college, which was I used to put together a lot of printed documents. I'd be at Kinko's at 2 a.m. putting together these proposals and reports. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could press a button and have your documents show up? And when I had that idea in the early 90s before the internet, it was a horrible idea. You didn't have digital print. You didn't have an internet. It was all going to be through modems. There weren't that many laptops, let alone cell phones. And it was too early. But by the late 90s, you had a very different environment. We hired a consultant, an analyst to gather data. I remember it was May 1998. He was supposed to spend the summer gathering data to figure out, at the end of the summer, we'd figure out whether or not we were going to launch a business. He comes back about 3 weeks later. He says, Jeff, you got to drop everything. We got to start this business. Stamps.com is an inferior business, and they just raised $1 billion. And this is a way better business. So we kind of dropped everything, raised $21 million. And back then, you needed to spend months and months to build software. The things that we would do today by looking at some GitHub open source code and pulling in some modules and spinning up some AWS servers back then was a lot of heavy lifting. We actually had 45 developers working for over 9 months before we even could approach a customer. So we didn't really do that sort of minimum viable product. So we got ready to launch, and then the internet bubble popped. And the software actually integrated with 140,000 square foot facility that we set up next to the FedEx hub. So at the time, we were burning a lot of money and didn't have a lot of customers yet. And we're expecting that we were about to go public, realized that we weren't. So we very quickly tightened our belt and managed to keep that going. That business called Mimeo, and eventually that became a 600, 700 person company with operations in Europe as well as here in the US. While growing that, we built out a sizable sales team. From that, got really interested in a couple things. One is, how do you scale a sales team? Also became really interested in how do you launch a business where you have customers before you even incorporate? With Mimeo, we spent millions and millions of dollars before we had a customer, and I wanted to figure out a way to do it the other way around. I started going around and talking to senior executives and saying, look, you've got a big budget. What is it you want to buy that you can't? And was talking to a woman who's works with Barry Diller at Interactive Corp. And she said, these things pop up on the internet and we get blindsided by it. It'd be great if we could monitor what was happening. So mocked some things up, did a little technical proof of concept, and went back and showed it to her. And she's like, oh yeah, this is great. Okay. I said, well, what do you think you would pay for this service that monitors the internet? And she said, I don't know. I'd probably pay $1,000 a month, maybe $2,000 a month. Wow. Okay. Well, I know there's a lot more executives like you out there, $24,000 a year, get a couple thousand customers. I see how this business grows. this is interesting. But at that same time, we had also been exploring this idea of using satellite data to sell it to hedge funds so that they could make better investment decisions. And I had this idea because I'd become a pilot. And one day I was looking down out the window, down on some buildings. And I was like, oh, wow, you can see the economic activity. You can see how many cars are parked in that parking lot. I wonder if you could, you know, sell this data with the satellite to hedge funds. We spent about 4 months exploring that idea. And what we found was that the hedge funds were, you know, willing to spend a lot to get differentiated information. Unfortunately, what we also found was that back then in the mid-2000s, there wasn't a lot of satellites. And I remember being on the phone just after spending 4 months building this business. I'm on the phone with a guy who works in Alaska by a dish where satellite data comes down and is transmitted. And you're talking about the process he was going to need to do with reprogramming his mainframe so that we could get the data we wanted from the satellite. And I realized that the business was not going to work. At the time, satellites were geared to working with the military and the government, and they kind of moved at the pace of government, not at the pace of a startup. And I just realized it was too early. So that was the last day we worked on that, but I'm going to leave that there because we're going to come back to that story almost a decade later in a minute. We gave up on the hedge fund data business for satellites. We had found a customer who wanted to monitor the internet. And my friend said to me, he goes, well, you know, hedge funds might want to know what's going on in the internet. I was like, oh, that's a great idea. Why don't I show them this? So I took the mock-up that I had for the corporations and I went to one of the hedge fund customers and I said, We think we can build a system that we can monitor the internet for information that looks like this and this. This is a little technical proof of concept we've done. They're like, wow, this is great. I said, well, would you pay $24,000 for it? Thinking maybe they'd pay $24,000 or $2,000 a month. And they turned to me and they said, oh, we would pay much more than $24,000 a month for this. So that was the last day we ever talked to a corporation about that. And from that day on, we worked with hedge funds. And that business, I'll get a little technical here, which you guys will have no problem with. We basically were using AI and big data and machine learning to scrape and harvest and analyze information from websites and blogs and Twitter feeds as they appeared, and then digested that and presented that back to hedge funds. And this was before the cloud, before AWS. So this meant that we had over 100 machines chewing through this data, running these algorithms. And to modify our algorithms, it would take a week of, you know, highly compensated experts sitting in a data center, reconfiguring machines. Basically, every modification of the algorithm would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars on millions of dollars worth of equipment. We have since done these same types of modifications on algorithms on much more machines. And generally, it takes about 10, 15 minutes. And it runs while we grab a cup of coffee, thanks to AWS. So fast forward, that business, we invested about $20 million into that business and realized that we were going to have to invest more to keep it going. It needed more R&D, and we decided to essentially wind that down and sell it. And it's a good example of being too early. A company called Datamere popped up after, just as we were winding down. And that's a billion-dollar plus company. And they had the benefit of the cloud, basically the same business model. And if you see Palantir started around the same time, again, digesting, analyzing, and visualizing lots of data. And I think what it shows is timing is really important on these businesses. That business, we learned a lot about machine learning and building algorithms. And I had been, because of the work at Mimio, fascinated with how do you predict which salespeople would be effective. Turns out about, you know, best practices, only about half your salespeople are above average. It just seems this keeps happening again and again. I thought if there was a way to improve the quality of your sales team, it has a huge return on the investment, allows you to grow faster, and allows you to be very much more capital efficient, which as an entrepreneur means you're going to own more of your company. So we started doing text analytics of interviews with salespeople to categorize them. And this was, you know, again, in the 2000s. And from that, developed behavioral assessments that you could do by transcribing a conversation. This is important because salespeople, you know, the better salespeople don't want to go fill out a bunch of questionnaires. The better salespeople want to talk and they want to sell. And if you force them to do big behavioral assessment tests, you get adverse selection bias. So we took in venture capital for that business. We grew it. We got to profitability. And in doing that, in doing all these businesses, we had teams that were abroad. We had developers in Argentina. We had developers in Guangzhou. We had business process outsourcing people on our team based in the Philippines. And I was talking with our supplier at the time, now business partner, based in the Philippines. And he said that our employees there couldn't get a loan. And this seemed really strange to me because these were very hardworking people. We trusted them with our business. Their incomes were going up. They were highly employable, but yet no bank would lend them money. And this meant that they couldn't send their kids to school, or they couldn't. They had to take a bus instead of having a moped, which meant they spent an extra hour or two a day commuting. Just a lot of human potential that couldn't be unlocked because of a lack of access to credit. So I said, well, if they need credit, how do they do it? And my business partner said, oh, well, they go to a loan shark, and you know, it's 4 or 5% interest rate. And I said, well, 4 or 5% interest rate. That's like a mortgage. And they said, no, it's 4 or 5% a month. And that's when I realized that there was, you know, this huge discrepancy between credit in the US or in the developed markets and credit for billions of people in the emerging market. And we had this, you know, really simple thesis, which is, well, if our algorithms can detect who is going to be a good salesperson, why can't we also look at data and figure out who's going to be a good borrower? Back then, there was a lot of data from the digital footprint, from your cell phone, from things like your social media footprint. We suspected that would be a good set of data for determining creditworthiness or willingness to repay a loan. The other thing we noticed was that Professor Yunus, who got a Nobel Prize for microfinance, proved that your community is very good at predicting who will repay a loan. And we figured that the communications between you and the rest of your community and who you communicate with and how they communicate with you would be highly predictive. So we set out to do this. You know, there was no one had ever done this before. We knew we needed data when you're building AI. So we just launched a lending company and we started giving out loans. And our initial algorithm was every fifth person got a loan because we needed data. So we just started issuing loans. And sure enough, after about a year of issuing loans, we got to the point where we could predict who would repay a loan. We then started to scale this globally. And ultimately, that business, Lendo, operated in over 21 countries and generally works with lenders and financial services providers to understand how do you extend credit to populations that aren't covered in a traditional credit bureau. That was certainly interesting. And in doing that, you know, that company was based out of Singapore. We had noticed that with a lot of the companies we were investing in or starting, they weren't going public. And meanwhile, while we were bouncing back and forth to Asia, investors kept asking us, how do we get access to startups? We're really excited about startups. So we had this simple idea of, well, why not take US technology companies or North American technology companies and list them in Asia? And we started digging into that idea and became completely fascinated with it because we knew that, you know, a lot of our friends had started companies. Yeah, the companies might be worth a couple $100 million, but still too small to go public in the US. And what we realized was that there's a very hungry market in Asia Pacific for US tech companies to list. And that it's not unusual to list cross-border. In fact, globally, about 10% of all IPOs are cross-border, meaning that the company where it's headquartered is not the company where it lists. So we decided to raise a fund and invest in companies where we thought we could help them accelerate growth outside the US and help them connect to the public markets, with the idea that a company that we invest in that has better access to capital is more likely to be a dominant player. And a company that we invest in that moves into the public market is more likely to be in a position where we can exit when appropriate. That's been what we've been working on for the last 3 years now. Coming up on 3 years is this what we call the Global Public Offering Fund, which has developed a playbook for investing in later stage companies that are too small to go public in the U.S., generally in the $100 to $500 million valuation range, but big enough that they would be well received outside the U.S. So that's sort of an overarching view of things that I've been working on and companies I've started. Maybe that's enough background to move into questions and talk about what you guys are most interested in.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. That's really exciting. I didn't know about all of those blips on the radar as in terms of the different startups that you're involved in. I knew probably three or four of them, but it's great to hear the full story. Jeff, it came up at one point in your talk where you described the cloud being a really impactful aspect of the things that allowed a startup to do. I was wondering if you could maybe expand on that. That's a paper that I had always wanted to write. Then I found somebody else that wrote it, did a good job. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you saw that emerge and the changes that the fact that it costs less to test an idea, how that rippled through the investment economy and other things like that.
Yeah, I guess I'll start towards the end of the story, which is artificial intelligence. A lot of the artificial intelligence algorithms that you're seeing today were developed in the 50s. The core AI it's academic papers from the 50s and 60s. What's changed is the data sets. Thanks to the internet, you have these massive data sets that allow you to analyze. You have the cloud that allows you to process that information in interesting ways. And I think, and I would say the mobile phone also generates an enormous amount of data and makes that AI available wherever you are. But the main thing is, when you can throw hundreds of machines at internet scale data sets, that is just absolutely incredible. And I think you're gonna see AI transform lots and lots of industries built on top of the fact that we now have cloud-based microservices where you can bring hundreds of machines to bear very quickly to experiment.
The work that you have done in the GPO fund, I remember coming across the research paper that you put out. Just curious if you could give a little more background about how that style of business model works. It looks like you've really put together this mature investment thesis that looks almost like an academic work. And I was just wanted to see if you could maybe, again, dive in a little bit more on that aspect.
Sure. Well, you know, I never got a PhD, so I'm compensating a little bit. But the idea behind the paper is we wanted to organize our thoughts. It's a bit counterintuitive, and we've seen this sort of in finance, this changes in thinking. You know, one example is the New York Stock Exchange used to only trade gold preferred shares, meaning preferred stock that was backed by gold. And there was this other thing called common stock, which was viewed as like a sucker's remnant. And then at some point around the 1900s, someone wrote a paper and did an analysis and said, hey, maybe this common stock is worth something. And today that's predominantly what's traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Michael Milken and Drexel Burnham did something very similar. You know, there used to be this, what was called junk bonds. And it was, you know, shitty companies use junk bonds. And they analyzed it and they said, well, wait a minute, maybe high yield is a respectable way to finance your business. And all of a sudden you had big, important companies using this form of financing to restructure and improve how capital is allocated. We think that the same thing's happening now, where, you know, people think, oh, well, you just stay private forever. But they forget that back in the 90s and the 80s, companies went public and regularly, hundreds of companies every year. So we think that the world is ripe for a new way to look at finance and basically say, you know, finance is not local. It used to be that if you wanted to go public, if you were in California, you went on the San Francisco Exchange. And if you were in Philadelphia, you went public on the Philadelphia Exchange. And then through the wonders of technology and telecommunications, this NASDAQ quoting system emerged. And all of a sudden, these local markets became a national market. We think the same thing's happening with global. Why should a company that's listed on the NASDAQ or listed on the Australian Stock Exchange or listed on the London Exchange only be available to people on the trading floor in London or sitting in England? We all have access to our phone. We all have Robinhood accounts. Why not have a truly global capital market? We think that's where we're going, and we're trying to lean into that to give the companies we invest in a more diversified and better capital base than if they just stuck with local VCs or even the local stock market.
So Jeff, last week we heard from Dwayne and how he had received a key piece of advice to you. How have you reached out to and worked with mentors through your journey? And do you have any advice to the students as they begin theirs?
Well, I think I was very fortunate to have great mentors. And I think part of it is working hard on whatever you're doing. And, people see that. Also, I think in America, 1 in 5 Americans could see themselves starting a business within 5 years. So there's a culture of supporting entrepreneurship and supporting entrepreneurs. I remember with my first business, we had a partner at Deloitte & Touche. No, it was Ernst & Young, I think. And he was my friend's father, and he was helping us. And here's a guy who works with mega corporations, bills hundreds of dollars an hour, and was doing it as a favor because he wanted to see us succeed. I think generally in the U.S., people want you to succeed as a startup. Back in around 2014, I was invited to Davos, and I was there talking about financial inclusion, and they invited me to a session on European startups. Davos goes till about 4 a.m. and at 4 a.m. you're having drinks with people, so you're not exactly, you're ready to sleep at that point. And this session started at 7 a.m. and I remember thinking, like, I'm not European. Why am I going to this session? Why am I only going to sleep, a couple hours here? And I'm so glad I did, because what happened was there was 110 Europeans somehow connected to entrepreneurship, the founder of Spotify, the minister of Estonia, the head of European entrepreneurship, the ministry of entrepreneurship, whatever. And what happened was everyone was complaining that you couldn't do a startup. No one wanted to invest in startups. No one wanted to work at a startup. No one wanted to hire a startup. And everybody wanted you to fail because if you did fail, it was over. You couldn't go back to another job. You kind of had this scarlet letter. But that really, I'm really glad I went to that session, because it really changed my view and got me to appreciate the level of entrepreneurship and mentorship that I've experienced here in North America. And so what I'd say is ask. People want to help. And I'd also say it's critically important. But also I'd say that a lot of the advice you get will be wrong. Someone may have lots of experience, but you're thinking about whatever you're building continuously, and you'll spot things that maybe people who've been in the industry much longer, are not spotting. Yeah, I don't know if that's helpful, but that's kind of my view towards mentorship.
Great. So one question we were trying to ask all the speakers, if you were a freshman at Rensselaer, what in particular would you get you excited that might relate somehow to entrepreneurship?
I think that a lot of the teams that I run and the business that I do is done remotely across culture. So anytime you're working in a team, that's going to be a great experience. But I think to the extent that you can engage in some sort of project where you have people from other parts of the world as part of your project team, that's a great experience. So I would say try to work on things that give you exposure to teammates and people in other parts of the world, because if you master that skill, you're just going to have a huge competitive advantage as an entrepreneur. One other thing I'll throw out is some of the most important people in how I do business and who I do business with, I met in college. You never know. You might be amazed at who you find yourself doing business with. I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Impactful Innovators podcast series. Be sure to continue listening as we explore more of the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. Thank you again to the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube, share it with a friend, or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, intrapreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond.